Welcome to another episode of Off the Menu. I'm your host, Vincent Franchini from Tumblr House, here with a Celtic Charles Coulombe.
Celtic? Is it Celtic you're calling me? Celtic? You mean to say one of those wild flippity gibbets who like their drink, you know, and the songs and the tales and the dancing? No, one of them?
Yeah. Yeah.
One of them folk who love to tell stories, you know, the old days, the old ways, who tend to be very conservative, you know, both in their religion and their politics, hold by the good old cause. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Well, I can't very well disagree with you now, can I? In fact, I will say that quite apart from my recently revealed ethnicity, thanks to DNA, being 60% Celt of various kinds. I always had a fascination with the Celtic peoples and cultures, and not, for the record, just the Scots, Irish, Manx, Welsh, Cornish, and Bretons, but also those people on the continent, those areas and regions that are held to be very strongly Celtic today, despite the loss of the language. And I'm referring to places like Galicia in Spain, Trasos Montes in Portugal, Auvergne and Savoie in France, Piemonte and Abruzzo in Italia, Tyrol and Bayern in Central Europe, and the Carpathians, the wild Carpathian mountains with their Valaks. And the Wallon in Belgium, and the Ardennes, the beautiful Ardennes. Save the language, they all have those other qualities. Those areas and various others like them love their wild and strange tales and lore, their music, their dancing, their drinking. And they tend to hold on to the old religion and the old loyalties in altar and throne. So, if that's what it is to be a Celt, count me in.
So you identify as a Celt now and not French Canadian. You're switching.
No, French Canadian is one ethnicity within the vast Celtic family.
French Canadian is Celtic?
Heavily. We have a lot of Breton blood. And of course, the French in general, they say that the French, on the average, are 60% Celt anyway because of the Gauls.
That doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, it does. The Gauls were sort of they were Celtic people that were conquered by the Romans, and they are the basic substrata of the French. The Bretons were different. They were Celtic refugees from Britain. But all those places I've described, certainly the ones I've been to, remind me very much. I mean, it's interesting that they all have heavy elven and fairy mythologies, because their lands remind me so much of what J.R.R. Tolkien described in Lord of the Rings as elven lands beyond the loon, green and quiet. And where do you find them but the mountains and the coasts, out-of-the-way places? So, and of course, there's the assertion that the elves have had more than a little bit of eruption of blood into the Celtic peoples themselves. Who's to say, you know?
Okay.
Well, they do say that in our village, you know, there's a family of harpers. Time out of mind, they've been harpers. The harpers, you know, they've been playing the harp time out of mind in that family. And the story goes that centuries ago, they weren't playing the harp in those days. The one of them was a shepherd. And one day he saw a lass sitting on a rock combing her hair, as beautiful as ever was seen in all of Ireland, or Wales, or Scotland, or wherever it is this happens to be. And he went up to her, and he was struck with love. But she said to him, "Well, I'll marry you, but I'm afraid that if you marry me, you must never strike me more than 3 times. For if you do, I'll have to return to my own people. I can never see you again. Well, they married. And sure, didn't they have 7 children, or was it 8? But at the marriage, at the wedding itself, he playfully slapped her, and she looked at him sadly and said, "That's true, my darling." Well, some years later, after she'd had so many kids, they got into a bit of an argument. And I'm afraid, not thinking, he slapped her shoulder. And she said, "That's the second time." Well, it so happened that the oldest boy was going to get married. And the funny thing about it was that in all of these years, although he had aged, she had not. Well, she did not like her son's choice. And he said to her, "Now come on, you know my mother had problems with you. You turned out all right." And he laughingly slapped her on the shoulder. And she said, "I'm afraid, my darling, that that's the third time." And she vanished. But you know, ever since then, all the sons of that family could play the harp without ever studying it. And so it's been from that day to this. And that is why they are the harpists of our village. That's a typical kind of story that they tell.
Mm. It's interesting.
Yeah, well.
All right.
Better than my singing the old orange flute.
I think the people like when you sing.
Do they?
Yeah.
Up the airy mountain, down the rushy glen, we daren't go a-hunting for fear of little men. We folk, good folk, trooping all together, green jacket, red coat, and white owl's feather. Up the craggy hillside, through the rushes bare, they have planted thorn trees for pleasure here and there. If any man should be so bold to pull them up in spite, he'll find the sharpest thorns in his bed at night. You don't want to go messing around with the fairies. They'll smack you down.
I believe it.
Look at RuPaul.
No.
All
right. I want to talk about something you posted on Timeline. It was very interesting. You posted about hate facts.
Oh, hate facts.
This was a revelation to me, so I had to look it up on Urban Dictionary to understand.
Did you think I made it up?
No, I didn't think you made it up. But I had to find out for myself. And so Urban Dictionary defines it as a state of affairs which has been proven to be true, but which is negative for or undesired by a protective group, such as women, ethnic minorities, homosexuals, etc. Wow. You know, and come to think of it, you present a lot of hate facts.
I do?
You do. And before the show, I can't even talk about what you were talking about because we'll just get canceled.
Well, no. I mean, it's a very simple thing. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, what the master of us all is referring to is a long, drawn-out court case between the United States government and 2 Indian tribes in Oklahoma, the Cherokee and the Seminole. Is this what you're talking about?
Yeah.
You want me to go on?
No, I don't want you to go on, actually, because I want the show to continue.
Well, you see, here it is. And you made a good point, though, and that is that the whole hate fact cult represents a step further than my nephew Albert's line.
Yeah.
Albert, Well, you know, it's a great line. I don't like that, so it's a lie. He used to say when he was little. Well, they admit now it's a fact, but you'll be punished if you reveal it. So that's a hate fact. And I kind of like that in a sense, because it's, well, just as the COVID monster made us all OCD, this thing, the wokeness and the critical theory and all that drivel is turning us all autistic, where the only thing real is me and my wants and my needs. And if there's anything beyond that, it's bad and evil. Ooh. So we're all going to be autistic, living in our own little world of self-comfort. And God help anybody who brings reality into it, because that'll be hate fact. So, my fellow autists, and you know, the sad thing is, it is an attack on real autistic people who, how do I put it, struggle very often valiantly with huge problems. I have a nephew who's autistic. I know a number of autists and Asperger's people and so on. These guys struggle valiantly with all sorts of problems. And in a sense, turning ourselves into autists the way we're doing is almost ridicule. It's the most ridiculous thing imaginable. You know, what's next? We're all going to become self-imposed Down syndrome people. You know, stupiditas triumphans is the motto of the present day. That is stupidity triumphant for you Latin fans. Although, by the same token, stupiditas omnia vincit. Stupidity conquers all. So, you know, why not? We're ruled by morons. I guess we should all become morons to emulate our lords and masters. So, see Heil, baby. Stupid, stupid morons.
I won't tolerate that Nazi talk.
What Nazi talk?
You said Sieg Heil.
Well, yeah, that means hail victory. They've won.
Yeah, but that has a Nazi connotation.
That's a hate fact. Gotcha.
Wow, that was actually pretty good, Charles. Well done.
Yeah, I thought so. I liked it.
All right.
I gotcha. It's a hate fact. Uh-huh. You can't say anything about it because I find it disturbing. Yep. I'm a Celt and a minority as a result. Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah. Gotcha.
Anything else new or you want to talk about on the intro before we get moving on?
Oh, well, I don't know. The fact that our military are about to be purged for ideological reasons? I don't know. Night of the Long Knives, American style. That's another Nazi reference. Hate fact. They didn't purge the
army. I'm getting mixed up. What was the German word for that? I'm remembering Kristallnacht, but that was Night of the Broken Glass.
Yeah. No, the Night of the Long Knives was actually the army. It was the opposite of what we're doing, in a sense. Basically, the army told Hitler that they were not going to tolerate some of his more revolutionary compadres, especially Ernst Röhm, who wanted to replace the army with a popular militia. So on that night, Hitler basically purged everybody who he considered a threat, starting with Röhm, and also including some important army officers and a lot of other people. It was the first coordinated act of Nazi brutality to catch people's attention. And it was a pretty awful occurrence. But this is more, I think, akin to Stalin's purging of the officer corps in 36, which ended up, when the Soviets had to fight the Germans a few years later, they were decimated initially because so many of their brightest and best had been tossed out. And so what they're talking about now is going after quote-unquote extremists. A friend of mine said to me, "Well, how could getting rid of racists from the army be a bad thing?" Well, it all depends on how you define racist. And considering what these guys are up to,
It's naivety to think that it will stop there.
yeah, I would definitely say so. But the friend in question is a foreigner and can't be expected to know anything about the way things work over here. And certainly, he's never served in his own armed forces. He can't be expected to know anything about ours. But it doesn't look fun, not at all. However, I'm not going to worry about it for an important reason. Can you guess why?
Because you're in Austria.
And I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
That's a hate fact.
Well, I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, it is, because it's saying that a free citizen of the United States doesn't count for anything in the decisions of his lords, masters, and owners in Washington. And while true, it's therefore hateful.
Okay, fair enough.
See? Two of us can play the hate fact game, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes
See?
two to tango.
You
Takes one to
bet.
know one.
That's right. And I know them all. That didn't go the way I wanted it to. Let's move on.
Right. I wanted to briefly go over something you posted on Facebook. So I'm gonna take
Well, we
an,
just did.
yeah, but well, you posted a lot of things on Facebook. So I want to go over something else you posted on Facebook.
Okay.
You say the news from America is extremely disturbing on many fronts, the more so because I can feel myself being radicalized by events, something I hate. Joining in a mob mentality is not something I want. In an effort to maintain my own equilibrium and yours, I'm going to refrain to the best of my ability from further commentary upon them. So, what do you mean here, joining a mob mentality, being radicalized, and what,
Well,
yeah.
what I mean is, I mean, it's like with this thing about the military. It's very annoying. It's very stupid. People are going to die because of this insanity. You get rid of some of your brightest and best for ideological reasons, it always goes wrong in the end. Mind you, even before any of this stuff came up, they were talking about lowering the SEALs' physical requirements so that women could participate. You know, that's not what the SEALs are about. It's not like women's sports. Well, of course, now by executive order, any university that has women's sports has to allow self-proclaimed women who are really men to participate, which means pretty soon you're just going to have men's sports and tranny sports. But that's all beside the point. The thing is that, well, I mean, it's like with the invasion of the Capitol. All right. On the one hand, this was not a good thing, you know, having the Capitol invaded. On the other hand, especially when I hear people like AOC babbling about how terrible it was, and thinking of how they didn't care when this when this, the country was going up in flames in the summer, part of me is like, yeah, have a little taste of it yourself, you worthless morons. Which is not a good thing. I mean, when I look, for instance, when I look at what was left, what was done to the cities in the summer, part of me wishes that it happened to the Capitol. But that would have been a terrible thing. This is what I mean by the mob mentality. I could feel myself getting angrier and angrier and wanting to approve things which I know are not right. I don't want to do that. Now, when I say that I'm going to restrict my commentary, I mean specifically on Facebook. Because I find in Facebook, people, they just go wild. And for quite a while now, I don't know how many of you listening are Facebook friends, but I'm going to let you in on a secret. I have been hiding, when I could get to them in time, I have been hiding comments that I thought would lead to people jumping up and down. And see, the other thing I've noticed, if I make a statement of some kind, people will often contradict me. I never go on their Facebook pages and contradict them. I'll read them, but I never contradict them because that's their opinion. It's their Facebook page. And the last thing I'd ever do if I were going to comment on it would be to attack someone commenting on a third person's page. And if I were going to do that, I would debate the content of their ideas, not call them stupid. You see? But this is what we've degenerated to. I mean, I said earlier, we've all become autistic. Well, the ability to discourse, thanks to the whole notion of, I'm not saying this explicitly, but the whole idea of hate facts and so on, it's gone down to basically we're like, you know, and now, gentlemen, we're going to have a reasoned debate. You, sir, what is your opinion of the issue at hand? I see. Thank you very much. And, sir, what is your rejoinder? Thank you very, very much. I would just like to say, ladies and gentlemen, in concluding this debate, for myself, I would simply like to say, thank you very much and good evening. That's what we're degenerating into. And it's got to stop. But you see, since we have no control over anyone else, all we can do is control ourselves. So from now on, not in this venue necessarily, but on Facebook, it won't just be bunnies, like you said before the show. I don't just do bunnies. I do history, Norman Rockwell, calendar customs, music I like, enjoyable stuff. I'm going to stick with all that.
There's so many areas we can take this discussion. But you're... citation of Facebook experience is very true. It's kind of a problem because so many people just go on and they vent. And it brings people down. Even though what they say might be true, you can't – you can't – a person isn't – people aren't built to constantly deal with screaming like this.
No.
You know? And I think that's why I was reading a report to content creators from the CEO of YouTube. Because, you know, they're cracking down on things that they consider hateful and borderline content. And she said what I suspected that they thought, which is that really – it's not a big deal. Like, it's such a small percentage. It's such a small thing, you know. And I had suspected that, you know, YouTube really could, they could really just remove all of Catholic content, quote unquote, whether it's hateful or not. And it's wouldn't even change anything. I mean, you add up all of the subscribers of everybody, you know, Taylor, all Catholic content, what, Ascension, Taylor Marshall, Bishop Barron, Census Fidelium, Return to Tradition, add up everybody. Maybe you get a million. And then you got someone like PewDiePie who has probably over 100 million. So right now where we're at is probably like 1%. The entire Catholic content is 1% of PewDiePie.
PewDiePie,
yeah, and that's just one content creator. He's a Scandinavian guy, He's, yeah, very popular. But why is this? You know, so much content when it's specifically Catholic, it's not fun, per se. You know, it's like the own little Catholic box, and a lot of it is brings people down. And so, in my opinion, what the my quest for the Holy Grail is Catholic content. You know, we handle things explicitly, and explicitly Catholic topics. What needs to happen is that there needs to be content creators that do all sorts of things, but it needs to be implicitly Catholic.
Oh.
It needs to be fun, it needs to be engaging, it needs to be interesting, and it needs to be implicitly Catholic. You see what I'm saying here?
Yeah, I do. What you're talking about is creating a climate.
A climate, yeah. Yeah. We need to be doing things where, you know, for example, like take all this profanity and blasphemy out of all this content, which would otherwise be acceptable to me.
Well, imagine, if you will, I mean, like, take World of Warcraft, okay?
Okay, yeah, sure.
Now, imagine a game as intricate as World of Warcraft, but based explicitly, say, on Arthur, Charlemagne, and the old legends.
Yeah.
Where virtue is its own reward. You know, where evil is evil, good is good.
Yeah.
You know, where even the magical elements are rigidly, the folklore is rigidly adhered to we'll put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, you can seek refuge at a saint shrine, that kind of thing. That would go a long way toward popularizing the faith without appearing to do so.
I agree.
I wouldn't know how to do that, but I'll bet some of you ITers out there, you would.
Yeah. I think it's going to happen. I think it's kind of slowly happening, but yeah, so I just wanted to get that thought in you content creators out there and get the wheels of your mind turning.
Could you imagine a game based on the Vendée?
That would be something.
Wouldn't that?
That would be incredible, where you're one of the Vendée and your goal is to settle things. Wow.
That would be something.
Hmm.
That would be something. There are so many episodes from Catholic history, the Crusades and so on. There are so many episodes that could be turned into games. The Reformation.
There was one, but it's always on a wrong side and a bad interpretation. Assassin's Creed is a very famous series.
I'm aware.
I think the first one was on the Crusades, but it was on how, you know, it's always against authority. That's the problem with Assassin's Creed, right? It's always against the authority.
This would be literally liberating the Holy Sepulchre.
Mm.
That would be the goal of the game.
Yeah.
And obviously, and you could have one seeking the Holy Grail, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, you could. Could you imagine one based on Joan of Arc?
Mm.
Yeah. See, there's a lot of stuff there, ladies and gentlemen.
So, all right. Let us go to the memes of production.
Nationalize the memes of production.
For the common good. All right. So the first one is from Fray Lucas Romsero, I think. Sorry if I spelled that incorrectly. On Twitter. So he's got Winnie the Pooh reacts to kids in cages. Not too impressed. Off the menu. Very impressed. That's fancy Winnie the Pooh right there.
That's good.
I kind of have no idea what's going on. I kind of caught a little bit of it on Twitter, which I guess Joe Biden is talking about kids in cages when it comes to immigration and stuff like that. I don't really know. I try not to watch news or go on social media anymore.
You know how Joe Biden likes kids.
How does he like kids?
I'm not going to say it.
Okay.
Available. That's not nice.
All right.
I told you it wasn't nice. It's a hate fact.
Yeah, I was going to say. All right. And next one I plucked from your Facebook page.
My Facebook? Oh, that one. Yeah.
How am I supposed to trust you when you keep running away every time I untie you?
I think that's a fair question.
When I read that, I actually read it in I heard it in Kathy Bates' voice from the movie Misery, where so you read the book of this where you've got a fanatical fan that captures the author, and it's a very dark tale.
I'll say. It's extremely dark, and if you're a writer like me, it's a very frightening one. That's why I try to stay away from all you get. Oh,
that's not true. That's not true.
I know it's not true. I love my fans, even the fanatics. You know, the ones who send me thousands of dollars in small unmarked bills.
Yeah,
I think that'd be a great way for any fanatical fans I've got to demonstrate their fanaticism.
I think so too. We're in perfect agreement, Charles. So send it to Tumblr House mailing address listed on the website. We'll forward it. We really like just petty cash, unmarked bills. You know?
No. You want to send it to Schloss Trumau in Austria. You don't want to send it. They've got. You don't want to bother my boss.
That costs a lot of money, though. We really want to help you out in this way, Charles.
No. See, dealing with all that petty cash would overwhelm the delicate balance under which Tumblr House functions. We don't want to bother them, ladies and gentlemen. We don't want to burden Tumblr House with all of those small bills. So you just send them to the Schloss, and I'll take care of them directly.
All right, fine. So be it, Charles.
I'd love to see them, you know.
Okay. All right, onto a more somber note. One of our patrons, Anthony, says, my close friend's father passed away a few days ago. Can you pray for the repose of his soul? His name was Daniel.
Daniel, we sure can. In nomine Patris, Filii, Spiritus Sancti. Amen. Ave Maria, gratia plena, benedicta tu, mulieribus, benedictus fructus ventris tui, Jesus. Santa Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis peccatoribus, nunc et in hora mortis nostrae. Amen. Eternal rest granted to him, O Lord, and perpetual light shine upon him. May his soul and the souls of all the faithful departed, the mercy of God, rest in peace. Amen. Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Amen. Well, sorry about that. This has been a terrible year for people dying. And not just because of COVID. You know, Christopher Plummer just died.
Really?
Yeah.
What, just today?
Yeah. 91.
Oh, man.
Yep. Goodbye, Captain von Trapp. It's, You know, it's funny. He was one of those fellows who've been around forever.
Yeah, he kind of got, as he got old, he got pigeonholed into this new area, and he did it very well. This sort of old man type cast.
Well, he was an old man.
No, so. I mean, but his voice had a certain softness to it and a cadence where it worked really well.
Yeah.
Sort of as an astute or wealthy man. I remember he was in The Insider with Al Pacino, and he's playing the kind of a Walter Cronkite type figure, I guess you could say. And The Inside Man with it was Spike Lee film. Yeah. I don't know if you've seen that.
Gosh. And he did a number of things. I mean, he kept working almost to the end. I know he just had a movie come out in 2018. It was a remarkable fellow, Canadian, you know. And he, yet being over here, I mean, I always remember when Sound of Music, when the Nazi fellow was yapping at him about what Austria is going to become. And his response was simply, "That's not my Austria." And he had this sadness and nostalgia and all sorts of things poured into the one very short phrase. Never forgotten that.
You probably can relate.
Yeah, I sure can. Not my America. Yeah, I must say that the similarities between the America into which I was born and the old Austria-Hungary in which I live, similarities have not eluded me. The difference being, of course, that the church is still here, despite everything, and the Habsburgs are still here. But the things that made our country what it was, they weren't tangible like that. And so it's very hard to see that they could ever come back in any form. But, it's like Reuben the bartender. I mean, to me, despite his being Mexican, and maybe in fact because of it, his standing there at Musso's, in a sense, epitomized everything I love about my country.
This was from the pre-show. Charles had a favorite bartender at Musso and Frank's, who's been there for forever. And that's what
You
he's
know, an old.
referring to.
That's what I'm referring to, ladies and
Got it.
gentlemen. Reuben. And he, the soda bartender who, if you hadn't been there for 10 years, you came back in, he'd make your drink exactly the way you liked it. And he epitomized the kind of, and the Musso's epitomizes the kind of place that says America to me. Red leather banquettes, neon sign with steak, seafood, cocktails, dark wood. That was the country I was born into, and the country I will miss till I die. But I can promise you this: if I make it back this summer, and if Musso's is real, if Musso's reopens, I'm going to get blotto one afternoon.
Whoa.
Yes, that's right. You heard it here first. I'm going to drink in honor of Reuben and in honor of every single bartender ever known like that over the course of 60 years. I've known quite a few. Libations out of their memories. I am going to get ossified, plastered, smashed.
All right, well, so be it.
I won't be driving, though.
Thank goodness for that.
You can't make me drive under those conditions. I don't care what it says in my contract.
All right.
Hate fact.
On to the questions.
Didn't want to get derailed, did you? You felt it coming close. The mysterious contract that requires me to drive drunk. You didn't want to go there, did you?
All right, question from Anthony, who
Audience will wonder what kind of a contract would that be? In return for services rendered, the party of the second part agrees never to get behind the wheel unless he's absolutely loaded.
Charles, please stop. The people don't like it when you're the only one laughing.
Is that what they're telling you
That's
now?
what they say. They get
Hate
angry.
fact.
Hate
Hate
fact.
fact.
Yeah. Okay. Does Charles know of examples of St. Valentine's Day being celebrated traditionally in Catholic countries? If so, can he share some? I'm only familiar with the American version of flowers and chocolates, but I wondered if there are places that celebrate it with a religious connection now or in the past. That's right, Valentine's Day coming up next Sunday.
It sure is. And, you know, just parenthetically about the 2 points about the American St. Valentine's Day. Of course, as soon as the Christmas decorations go out of the stores, the red hearts go up. You know, immediately. And that that's always struck me as sort of the last blast of advertising continuity. Because you know what happens. In late July, early August, the Halloween stuff goes up. Or starts to. And it's certainly there by September. Then, long about early to mid-October, the Christmas stuff comes up. Well, the Halloween stuff is still there. So you get this weird Nightmare Before Christmas feeling in a lot of major stores. We've got one side is all Halloween, the other side is all Christmas. Which, oddly enough, even though it's kind of stupid in a lot of ways, I enjoy looking at, you know, looking at the two. Although Thanksgiving kind of vanishes now as a result. You don't see too many Thanksgiving stuff. Anyway, then with Halloween gone, it's all Christmas. Except a little bit of Thanksgiving stuff in some stores, usually supermarkets, because they have turkeys to sell. And then Christmas comes, the Christmas stuff goes out, in come the red hearts. And the red until St. Valentine's Day, at which time, you replace them with either Easter eggs and Easter stuff, or in a few places we'll have St. Patrick's Day things. But then after Easter,
we know how we do it, Charles. He's asking how it's celebrated traditionally in Catholic countries.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'm getting there. I've got to ease this into it because it's so foreign. I've got to ease you into it. You can't do these things specifically. Love can't be hurried. Okay? You can't push love. St. Valentine's Day is about love. It's not about hurry up and pay the bill. It's about love. All right?
What about tough love?
Tough love should be hurried real quick. I can think of one group of national leaders, or maybe several, that could use a lot of tough love at the moment from their subjects. But anyway, let's move along from that. I'd also like to say, parenthetically and not relating to much of anything, do you know who the filmmaker Henry Jaglom is?
No.
Well, he's a filmmaker who does these sort of arty films. I don't know who watches them, but he keeps making them. And one of them had to do with St. Valentine's Day. And the only reason I mention it is because it featured Orson Welles' last appearance. And if you remember Orson Welles, I mean, he could appear in anything, you know. Hello, I'm Orson Welles. This cup came from IKEA. And you'd watch just because it was Orson Welles. It didn't matter what he was saying. He was amazing. Anyway.
Yeah, this is all part of the slow intro to answering the question. Yeah, Orson Welles got it. Okay. Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Orson Welles did get it.
Yeah.
I'm glad you figured that out.
Yeah.
You said Orson Welles got it. I said, yes, he got it. He did get it.
Yeah.
All right. So moving on. St. Valentine was, of course, a Roman martyr in the early church, and his skull, crowned with flowers, may be seen today in Santa Maria in Cosmodine in Rome. But he has other relics elsewhere, in Dublin, Poland, and some other places. Wherever you'll find relics of St. Valentine in Catholic countries, people, lovers, will, on St. Valentine's Day, be they Italian or Irish or Polish or anywhere else these relics are found, they will make a pilgrimage and pray to him that their love, A, be, you know, successful, and that it be holy. Now, interestingly enough, as with Halloween, Christmas, and so much else, we took this and repackaged it. But the notion of St. Valentine as the patron of lovers actually goes as far back, at least, as the time of Geoffrey Chaucer in the early 1400s. So, and I should tell you also that he was taken, although he's still in the Martyrology, he was taken out of the calendar in 69. So if you can get to a Tridentine Mass on St. Valentine's Day, although this year it's a Sunday, so it'll be subsumed. Nevertheless, normally, that's a good thing to do. Take your girlfriend or significant other to a Mass of St. Valentine on St. Valentine's Day. It means you have to find a Tridentine Mass, but so much the better.
He got taken off the calendar?
Well, yeah, a lot of people did in 69.
That's a big removal, though.
No, they had nothing better to do with their time than pull stuff out.
I mean, who do they remove him in favor of? You know? Like, that's...
That is a good question, and the answer is, I do not know. But I will find out. Give me just a moment, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm really curious to see who trumps St. Valentine.
Well, in the new calendar, St. Cyril and Methodius.
What?
Saints Cyril and Methodius in the new calendar. They were July 7th, but in 69 they bumped St. Valentine.
I'm not familiar.
Cyril and Methodius, they were the apostles of the Slavs, and they're co-patrons of Europe with St. Benedict.
Hmm.
They were the ones who brought the faith to your ancestors, your Slovak ancestors.
Okay. Well, then that's justified. Brothers. Get him out of here. Just get him out. There's a door, St. Valentine. We'll be seeing.
Get rid of the Italian.
Was he Italian, though? I mean.
Yeah.
Oh, that's tough, then.
So you want to get rid of the Italian in favor of the Slovak. I get it. No, it's fine. You know, those of you who are ethnically mixed have to struggle with this kind of thing all the time. Those of us who are 100% pure, we don't have these problems.
All right, is there anything else to the... There's just no winning here.
What do you mean?
I mean, you rigged the game.
What do you mean I rigged the game?
Are you just going to repeat everything I say in question form?
Not everything. Some things I'll repeat in other forms. You know, you're seeming very stressed right now. Have you considered thinking a little more about Cthulhu?
Why? Why would I do that?
Well, in his house at Rilia, Great Cthulhu lies dreaming.
What?
That's true.
You're just saying gibberish now.
No, I'm not saying gibberish.
I don't care if Cthulhu's dreaming in some weird place.
Would you rather he dreamt in a decent place? Macy's entrance hall, perhaps. Or the Yankee College, or the Dodger Stadium, maybe.
All right.
Big elephantine tentacle thing in the middle of Dodger Stadium, just snoozing for all the world to see. Would that be preferable?
I don't like the choices here. I feel like it's a rigged game. You see, you're still rigging it. It's like, oh well, do you throw the Slavs under the bus or Italy under the bus? Oh, like, what part of, you know, your identity are you gonna?
Giving you choices here, and you rebel against the concept of choice itself.
Oh, do you want a hemlock or a bullet in the head? Do you want?
That's a good question. Oh. Either has its advantages, You have to look at the bright side in all of this. Your problem is you've given in to thinking negatively. Hate fact.
All right. Well, let's get into something positive. Let's get on to a topic that really excites me. And so we've got a question from Michael, who does a nice introduction here. He says, "Hello, Mr. Coulombe. I recently finished reading your book, Blessed Charles of Austria, available at TumblrHouse.com for $27.95 with free shipping and handling. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, which is why I will be writing a review on the Tumblr House website and get $5 off my next order, which will certainly include free shipping and handling, being over $25 for a steal of $20 worth of books with free shipping and handling and a savings of $5, which will then be spent on more Tumblr House books with the same deal ad infinitum."
Is that little Mikey Franchini trying to get into the mailroom again?
No, this absolutely not. This is a proud patron of Tumblr House, and you don't understand what he just did here. He just unlocked...
I know exactly what he did. He sounded like one of your relatives angling for a job.
What he has just done is unlocked one of the constants of the universe.
Cash?
Absolutely. See, what you have here is you have infinite spending equals infinite savings.
That boy got to go into government.
I mean,
you were just, this is a secretary, you're right. This is a secretary of the treasury in training.
Yeah. So
infinite spending equals infinite savings.
Yeah. And
what's not to like?
That begs the question. Why do you even need a savings account when you could be spending all your money on books on Tumblr House and have even more savings? Really? 1% interest? Really? Is that what we're going to do on the savings account? You're taking out a CD, get that, maybe that interest up to 1.5% if you're lucky.
You see, take that ladies money, and gentlemen,
spend it on books at Tumblr House. You'll get a lot more bang for your buck. I can tell you that.
All my worries about our country have been banished. knowing that our economy will be in the hands of such men, I have absolutely no worry now. I look forward to the 22nd century with quivering anticipation.
All right. Thank you for that, Michael. That was just one of the best introductions I've ever heard.
You made the boss man very happy today, Michael. Even if you're not a Franchini, you won't be getting a job as a result of it.
All right, on to his question.
All right.
He says, his question regards the church's practice of interdiction. My understanding is that historically, a country would be placed under an interdict. No masses or sacraments would be allowed to be celebrated in that country, depriving the population of the sacraments. It seems unjust that the Catholic population should be deprived of receiving sanctifying grace just because the king or elected assembly have fallen from favor with Rome. Could Charles shed light on this apparent problem? Also, when was the last time a country was placed under an interdict?
Well, I'll answer the second first. Most of the world this past year. Mind you, it wasn't an official interdict, but certainly the sacraments were suspended. I suppose everyone was being punished because there was evil COVID in the air, and so everyone had to pay the price for it. But to answer your question, the last real interdict, that is to say the last legal one, was, I believe, in Mexico in the 20s, when the government was persecuting the church, so they closed the churches. Normally, of course, as you might guess, this was done to try to pressure the rulership through arousing the annoyance of their subjects. And that was the reason it was done. Now, obviously, this was kind of a nuclear option. And it would only be done if something really severe had happened. So when St. Thomas a Becket was murdered, England was put under interdict. And the people were sufficiently outraged to force the king to make his obeisance. The same was true with Emperor Henry and Gregory the Seventh, which is what initially brought Henry to Canossa. It was not something that was done lightly, nor easily. And of course, there were certain exceptions to it. I mean, the last rites were administered during interdict, the viaticum and the last confession and all that. But it was considered that it would, with any luck, annoy the subjects enough that they would pressure their rulership into coming to an accord with the church. And it obviously it worked often enough for them to do it, which points up a difference between life today and life then. That is to say that in those days, the subjects had enough of a voice with their masters that annoying them via an interdict so that they would do something was seen as something effective. Today, there'd be no point because, of course, we have no control over our masters. We don't have the bond with them that our ancestors had with their sovereigns. Just the fact that his people were being deprived of the sacraments because of him would make an effect on a ruler, even if his people didn't rise up. So, I mean, it's ironic, but as government has become much less personal and the connection between the subjects and the sovereigns has degenerated into one between property and owners, the interdict doesn't really have much effectiveness anymore, as seen by the fact that the almost universal interdict this past year hasn't meant anything except to point up to the fact that the church has no autonomy from the state today.
Okay.
One of the things I pointed out about the shutting down of the churches is that it showed that you can't really talk about church and state anymore, except in the sense that you could talk about Rotary Club and state, or YMCA and state, or Boy Scouts and state. In other words, the church is just one more little group like another that really don't mean anything in the scheme of things. A role which a lot of the church's leadership have accepted without any demur.
Yeah, they seem to be pretty chill with the state finding them to be non-essential and not needed.
Yeah, they don't have a problem with that, and I hope that they won't be too upset when they find a lot more of their people regarding them the same way. I hope this doesn't upset them.
You know, the shocking thing is that they don't even seem to be upset by that.
No. No, they don't.
That's what really gets me. You know what I mean? Like,
well, see, those who have that view, and there are some who don't, but those who do have that view, remember, they don't believe that the salvation of souls depends on their little rituals anyway.
I know, but what I'm saying is, it's shocking to me because even if you have no faith and you're just in it for a steady salary, you should mind, right?
Well, you would if you thought about a future. But see, remember, in a sense, they've got the worst of both worlds because clerics of their nature do not think of the future the way married men do.
Oh, I guess that's because true.
It is true. They have no descendants. And if they have no faith, they have no descendants, they don't really care about anything beyond them. Après moi le déluge, in the immortal words of Louis XV. They don't care.
Well, you know, I guess I assume they would on some level because they have a parish and men, I think at some point, like to create a legacy, to build something lasting.
Normal men do. A lot of these are not normal men.
Okay.
And I have to add, too, that remember that they've been talking for years in terms of planned decline. That is to say, they expect the church to shrink. And they sell off the property very gleefully. And that's that. Especially in the major urban dioceses. But as I say, they will get their reward.
There's more outspoken people, prelates, a little bit. I was talking to my mom about who's the head of San Francisco Diocese?
Corleone.
Yeah. He's a tough old boy.
He is. Well, I mean, he's got a name that he has to live up to. Part of a lion. I mean, you know, if that were your last name, you'd have to. What are you going to do? Hi, I'm Archbishop Corleone. You can't do that, not with a name like that. You're stuck. You know, it's your name, Lionheart. You can't be a wuss when you've got a name like that. You just don't have a choice. Yeah. You might be by nature the sweetest, most inoffensive, self-effacing person on the planet. But if you're stuck with a name like that, you got to roar. You don't have a choice about it.
It's true. Us Italians, looks like we're going to have to do the job to keep up our reputation. Because everyone else, you know, I mean, these French people, Spanish, I don't know, these other cultures, I don't know. They just don't seem to have it in them, you know, that fire.
I can say you've not been to Italy recently, but that's all right. I was in Rome, oddly enough. And this shows you how embarrassing it can be. And I was in Rome in 2000 for the, as it so happened, it's not why I was there, but it was by coinkydink, the very time of the first gay pride parade in Rome. And it was organized, as you might expect, by an American chick. But obviously, if you're an American in Rome at that time, you're immediately suspect, if you know what I mean. So, as it happened, how did this work out? I asked the guy at the desk a question. I forget what it was now. I don't remember. But his response, which was completely inappropriate, was, I get off at 7. Oh, no, I remember. I said, I've got a question for you. Now, the question had to do with the next day's breakfast. But I said to him, I've got a question for you. And he goes, I get off at 7. And I said, that's great, but that wasn't the question I had. I wanted to know about tomorrow morning's breakfast. Oh, he got very embarrassed. He turned red as a beet. But I realized later that he presumed, since I was an American, I must be in town for the parade. I'm sorry, you were saying something about the supremacy of Italian culture. Where'd you go? All better now?
I have no words.
Hate fact. Hate fact. I gave you words. So you could just throw that at me and I'd have to shut up about it. Now come on. Play the hate fact card. You know you can. Let's hear those magic words.
No, I'm not going to be hateful. I'm going to say yes to love and no to hate.
Well, that certainly was a love fact. There's a whole lot of loving going on, let me tell you.
All right. Okay. All right, Charles. Control thyself.
I'm just thinking now of all the opportunities that the opposite brings us. Love fact. You can do it. I mean, you can throw that at so many things and make anything seem ridiculous. The problem we got right now, we got too many love facts going on. Got to restrain ourselves, you know. Got to cut down on all them love facts.
Wow.
I think we got one too many love facts.
All right.
Well, St. Valentine's Day is coming up.
Yeah, St. Valentine's Day.
I'm the patron of love facts.
Don't say that. The patron of love facts. Okay.
Love fact number one. Couples in love on the feast of St. Valentine's Day in Dublin go to the Church of the Carmelites, Whitefriars, because they have relics of St. Valentine's. That is a bona fide love fact.
All right. Four questions from Diego.
Oh, boy. You're talking about love facts.
What is that? Yeah, what? How is that a love fact?
No, just counting. There are four questions. Love facts. You realize a love fact, all the questions that are given us out of a regard for our opinions. Now, if that isn't a love fact, I don't know what is.
Mm, that's nice.
See?
All right, Diego says, I am aware that Charles has mentioned different days and months as being special feasts in the church calendar, but I wanted to know what each month is in the church year. For example, June is the month of the Sacred Heart. July is the Precious Blood. September is for the Holy Angels. November is the month of the Holy Souls. If Charles can go over the months once more without cheating, please enable him to do so.
Ha-ha, you wish. Well, January is the month of the Holy Name of Jesus. Why? Because that's what the feast of the Holy Name of Jesus is. February is the Holy Family. March. F. What's that?
You're getting an F for cheating. I can see when you're using the computer, Charles.
I don't care.
I'm so disappointed and disillusioned.
Hate fact.
All right, go on. I'm sorry.
Hate fact. March is St. Joseph. April is the Holy Eucharist. May, the Virgin, Blessed Virgin Mary. As we know, June is the Sacred Heart. July is the Precious Blood. August is the Immaculate Heart because traditionally August 22nd was the Feast of the Immaculate Heart. September, interesting. September gets two attributions. The Holy Angels because of Michaelmas, but also the Sorrowful Mother because of the Feast of the Seven Dolors of Mary. So it's a double whammy. October is the Holy Rosary because the Feast of the Holy Rosary, October the 7th. November, the Holy Souls, and December, the Immaculate Conception. Now, as we know, when you point out that I'm cheating, this is a hate fact. So I want to replace the hate fact with a love fact.
Okay.
The love fact is, I decided that that question was so important, it needed an answer that was definitely reliable. I did not want to rely on my spotty memory.
Okay.
I wanted to give the ultimate best value for your audience that I possibly could.
So the ends justify the means.
Hate fact.
All right, fine. Fine, Charles, you win.
Hate fact versus love fact.
Okay.
Celtic hate fact versus Celtic love fact.
All right. Not to derail this, but the Gratuitous Blood, Consecration of St. Joseph by Father Donald H. Calloway. I have to say, we have sold more copies of this book than any other book by far. I can't tell you how many books that we have sold. Or how many copies of this we've sold this past month. There's so many. All these churches are just gobbling this up. Everyone's doing this program. And I didn't know March was also the month of St. Joseph. I'm pretty sure there's his feast day. One of his feast days are in March. So everyone's doing, because I think it's over time. My mom is doing this. I think it was
March 19th.
March 19th. So there's 30 days or so of doing the consecration. Everyone's doing it. I need to. I intend to. I think I'm going to do it for St. Joseph the Worker, and I think that's May 1st, if I'm not mistaken.
It's May 1st. Interesting thing about that is that it used to be, I think the third or fourth Sunday after Pentecost was St. Joseph's Day. And then Pius XII moved, renamed it St. Joseph the Worker and moved it to May 1st to derail the communist use of May 1st as May Day.
Nice. See, I like that kind of tactical move. I hope we get a pope that does kind of counteracts like this new calendar we're forging with Earth Day and World Day and.
I don't know. I'm pretty excited because, amongst other things, March is coming up. And after March is April. And April is Moronic Supremacy Month.
I don't know what to say to that. That's not true. That's fake news.
What do you mean? Hate fact. What do you mean, Firstly, Moronic Supremacy Month is an important time when, beginning on April Fool's Day, we are able to celebrate the nature of those who own us, lock, stock, and barrel. They can have us wear masks, confine us to our homes, shut everything down. They have complete power over us, and we get to celebrate that.
Bad touch, Charles. Next question.
What are you doing for Moronic Supremacy Month?
Next
How
question.
Do you plan to observe?
No, bad touch. Ultra vires. This is beyond your. What you're doing is ultra vires. You can't do this. This is my show.
I can't make up stupid months on my own.
This is my show. You don't get to do that.
Oh. Hate fact.
All right. Another question from Diego. Recently, I've got to pondering on oaths. I've remembered Charles mentioning that oaths with the devil are improper and not valid. So my questions are, what is an oath? What constitutes a valid oath? What renders an oath invalid? Are oaths one way? Do they need mutual consent? Is an oath to God above that of country? And can I make an oath or proclamation to God, and is it valid?
Well, that's your question. An oath is a solemn undertaking to do something. The most solemn undertaking there is, the most solemn assurance that there is. Because inevitably you swear by God himself that you will do this or such. Now, mind you, the requirement to do so is mitigated or completely dispensed if the oath is A, extracted from you by threat of force or violence, if it's done out of ignorance. These are all mitigating circumstances, not unlike, frankly, the reasons for an annulment of an invalid marriage. Very similar, because the oath is a vow. And if a vow for any one of a number of reasons is not validly taken, that it's.
I see. An oath is a vow. So an oath is more than a promise.
Oh, yeah. Much more.
Okay.
Much more. In terms of it only being one-sided, yeah. It's a covenant, if you like. And covenants can be one-sided. In other words, they can be two-sided in the sense that I swear I'll do this and such if you'll do this and such. Or they could be totally one-sided. I will do this and such regardless of what you do. God made all sorts of covenants with the chosen people in the Old Testament. usually along the lines of, I'll do this if you'll do that. But there was some, like, I will not destroy the world by water again. That was a one-sided covenant, the covenant with Noah. Noah didn't have to do anything. He just, okay. So to answer your question, yeah, you can do a one-sided covenant if you like, one-sided oath, one-sided vow. And you can make one to God. You can vow to God that you'll do this and such. I mean, that's what religious vows are all about. That's what the vows of the knights were about. You know, to go on crusade or to rescue someone or whatever it might be. Those are all one-sided.
Right. Next question. This is a long one. So as Betty White says, buckle up. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
It's not Betty White. It's Betty Davis.
You sure?
Yes. It's Betty Davis in All About Eve. Betty Davis. Have you ever heard of anybody having Betty White eyes?
No.
It was Betty Davis eyes.
Okay. All right, Charles.
Do you consider Betty White sultry and mysterious?
No.
No. Do you consider Betty Davis sultry and mysterious?
No.
Well, you just consider her old and dead, but still. You think she was rough?
Yeah, she was rough. I don't like her style.
She was an utter sweetheart. What are you talking about?
All right. We're not going to get into this right now, Charles. I'm going to ask the question and you're going to give an answer.
Oh, gee. You're getting very masterful all of a sudden. You find Betty Davis threatening.
I find Betty Davis annoying.
Well, that's what I said. All right. Go ahead. Ask your question.
You're out of control today. You need to check yourself.
Love fact.
All right. Being a cradle Catholic, my experience with the faith has been rocky to say the least. It has only been recently that I finally found that solid foundation God has set for me, although I still tend to ignore it. But in doing so, I've come to realize that people don't truly know the faith, do they? I mean, my parents do their best, but when my older sibling decided to shack up with someone else and me telling my mother that it was sinful, she acknowledged it, but said that it was how things were done. Or recently when family visited and asking me questions, me casually mentioning that I just desire God at the moment and want to love him, they sort of playfully laughed and asked if I wanted to be a religious man, which I'd rather not, or having to tell my younger sibling that saints aren't perfect people, otherwise they can't be saved. Things of that nature, definitely wrong, but like it's just sort of accepted. That's when the realization that, at least familially speaking, the faith is something you do, like baptizing newborns or throwing confirmation parties or maintaining family traditions, but not really know or love. Not to say that this makes me better. My parents know scripture and I don't. Rather, I see this as God's way for me evangelizing. But therein lies my question. I just don't believe I'm capable of evangelizing. I try to, but it's very minimal, and I'm still working on reforming myself into an industrious pillar of the decaying Western civilization. Point being, do I continue to fight this dual uphill battle, myself and those I care about, not just family, or is giving and letting the church and her pastors do her job for me? Okay.
Well, the answer to me is very obvious. You keep trying to do it your best you can as you're trying to improve yourself. In fact, trying to evangelize is part of trying to improve yourself. It's not a separate add-on. As far as leaving the church and her pastors to do the work, I wouldn't if I were you. Even at the best of times, you as a layman will go to places where no priest would ever enter, be able to enter. your place of business, the friends you have, etc. And that's in the best of times. These are not the best of times. Leaving the church and the clergy, the institutional church, because you are, remember, and this is the one time I will say we can actually get away with saying we are a church, is we are the church when it's a question of bringing the faith to someone who doesn't have it. Then we certainly are the church. We're the part of the royal priesthood. We are cells in the mystical body of Christ. And it is our obligation to bring it to anyone we can who will listen.
You know, I think there's a sort of structure to this. With most people, I think there's baby steps. Like when we say evangelization, I think most people aren't ready for extra ecclesiam nulla solus. You know, I think it's, as I was saying in the pre-show, we defend the, all we need to do right now is defend the truth on the simplest matters. I mean, and we can't even do that. The unborn are people. There are two genders. Face tattoos are hideous. You know, these are very, shacking up is no,
wrong.
No bueno. These are very, I mean, there are silver bullets that I feel that can be charitably gotten across to anyone.
Well, one of the ways, you know, interestingly enough, that you can do this is by referring to things by their right name, but as cast-offs. In other words, you don't say shacking up, just shacking up.
Yeah.
Oh, infanticide. Yeah. Okay. You know, without any appearance of moral, let the words themselves sink in. You don't have to act at all outraged. They'll get outraged. And you just look at them blankly. What? You're killing the kid, aren't you? It's infanticide.
No, it's women's rights.
Sure. Whatever you say, pal. Yeah, okay. But you see, that's my point. You take control of the linguistic ground.
Yeah.
You know, I remember years and years ago when I was working at the fabulous Century Plaza Hotel, one of the chambermaids very happily reported to me that she was moving in with her boyfriend. And I said, you're shacking up. Oh, did she get angry at me? And she says, oh, that's a horrible thing to say. I said, what, that you're shacking up? Well, I don't know. It's no worse than doing it. And she says, no, you're making something beautiful seem sordid. I said, well, it is sordid. You know, I'm thinking of you to marry you, but, you know, you don't mind, so why should he? But she didn't do it in the end.
Hmm.
She wasn't happy with me, but she didn't move in with him.
I think the other thing, too, when it comes to thinking about evangelizing is don't expect some sort of big transcendental don't expect a big transcendent change in the person. Like, no. Oh, wow, now I'm, you know, a Latin mass going Catholic.
Now you've explained the truth to me. Where have I been all my life?
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly.
That doesn't happen very often. It does happen sometimes, but it doesn't happen often.
Yeah, you don't know what impact, what has seeped in. Some of the satisfaction I've got is where I've given people a line and they, you know, I see them years later and they tell me that line and you can tell they were chewing on it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and the other thing too is that sometimes people will surprise you by accepting things that you think you're going to have a fight. And you don't. I mean, I remember when a fellow I knew was dying of AIDS years ago for the usual reason. And, but I mean, he was repentant. He'd seen the priest and all that. But he was dying. And I'd see him once or twice or three times a week at that point. And he got to a day when who stopped feeling, he stopped having good days. He was miserable all the time. And he asked me, he said, why don't I just end it? I'm miserable all the time. I'm not going to get any better. I'm going to die. Why don't I just kill myself? And, you know, I hated being in that position because, of course, I wasn't particularly in any discomfort, but I knew what I had to tell him. So I said, well, firstly, apart from the fact that you'd go to hell, which is never a good plan, you could do something that you couldn't do before, which is you can offer up your pains, not just for your own sins, but those of your friends, like me, who could use it. Well, I thought I was going to have sort of a fight on my hands of some kind, right? He looks here and goes, oh, all right. And that was it. Until he died, he never spoke of it again. And I mean, I thought this was going to be some huge drama. No. All he needed was a rational explanation, or what to the Catholic would appear like a rational explanation. I know that there are many people who would say that what I said was insanity. But he took it at face value and was, you know, it was fine. It was content. That's the thing. Everyone's different.
And don't think of just a traditional conversation, too. It's like where there's discourse. There are many different ways to be an example to people. You see it in Charles right away. His dress, the way he acts, even before he's actually putting forth an argument, he's actually putting forth an argument with the way he acts, and it impresses people. That is a form, in my opinion. That has an impact on people. For me, for my part, my own style of that, I guess, is when I perhaps I have a Sacred Heart shirt on with a big Sacred Heart, or perhaps Knights of Columbus. I love, as I've said before, I love walking around the neighborhood and really greeting people, you know, making eye contact and being super nice. And I feel like that alone, you know, they see me, they see how friendly I am, and then they see what I represent, what I'm standing for. And then that makes an impression. Like, oh, wow, maybe Kamala Harris is completely wrong about the Knights of Columbus. Maybe, you know, these Catholics are nice, friendly people. You know, you see what I'm saying? You don't have to do this elevated, you know, intellectual discourse to evangelize. There's so many different ways. And as I was saying before, with content creation implicitly, live your, you know, have the faith and just live it. And it will, you will implicitly be having an impact on people.
And also pray to the Holy Ghost to enlighten you. You know, in the gospel, our Lord says that if you're arrested, etc., it'll be, don't worry about what you're to say. It'll be given you. But that's presuming that, you know, you pray to the Holy Ghost for that inspiration. And you will get it. You know, and it can come up in any number of ways. I mean, I remember I was in North Dakota once. And I was talking to a Norwegian Lutheran, and I forget how we got onto it, but I mentioned that the patron saint of Norway, Saint Olaf, had brought the Catholic faith to Norway. And he looked at me and he said, "But I thought Saint Olaf was a Lutheran." And I said, "Sir, when did Saint Olaf live? About 1000. When did Martin Luther live? About 1500. And then there was like this long pause. He goes, "Oh, oh, oh, oh." Well, I left. I could see an entire worldview crumble before my eyes. I left the shop. But I mention it because you don't know, even the odd factoid that you throw out might make a difference. So, and above all, don't wait until you become worthy, because none of us will ever be worthy in that sense. Not until we're dead.
Right. Yeah, but I struggle with that myself, actually. It's like, who am I that I should, be saying things?
And the answer is very simple. Let's put it into less obvious terms. Everyone's starving, and you've got cans of spam. You don't even like spam. But people are starving. Well, it's still going to feed them. And you're not Ramsay, the hero chef. You're Joe Schmo, and you've got these lousy cans of spam. But people are starving. You've got the means of feeding them. Very few other people do. And Gordon Ramsay is not running around bringing gourmet food to people.
Diego's last question, can Charles explain the Hussite heresy that led to the great defenestrations of Prague? And to Vincent, please make him do so. Okay, do so, Charles. Wow.
Okay. Well, Jan Hus was a Czech, a Bohemian chap, priest, who picked up some of the heresies of Wycliffe, who was an English priest. Sola Scriptura, the Bible alone, a lot of other anti-hierarchical things. He started out, his disenchantment with the church came when he was sent to investigate an alleged Eucharistic miracle in a town called Wilsack in Brandenburg. He decided that it was phony, and then from that he decided the transubstantiation was phony. And then from that, well, he just started knocking down one doctrine after another. And also, he was very much against the idea of the laity only receiving in one kind. Now, this was kind of interesting because he didn't really believe in the real presence. So why it would have mattered, I don't know. Anyway, he was sentenced to death at the Council of Constance. He was executed. He had already created a lot of supporters. But his supporters veered from conservatives who just wanted communion in both kinds to wild men who wanted to abolish all social order. So after they defeated the imperial forces, they turned on each other. And this was all in Czechia and their adjoining areas. And so because of their internal disunity and because of some of the weird excesses carried out by the wilder section, the more conservative section returned to the Catholic Church and helped suppress the others. And so the remnants of it, of the Hussites, were found in remote places. And eventually, the biggest part of them were gathered up by a German pietist nobleman called Nicholas Count von Zinzendorf, who had an estate in Saxony called Hirnhut, which to this day is the headquarters of what became known as the Moravian Church.
So the interesting factoid from this is that it's pre-Martin Luther, pre-Protestant Revolution.
Right, about 100 years before.
So a couple questions emanate from this. One, do you feel that this heresy influenced Martin Luther?
No, but it did influence a lot of later Lutherans because they came into contact with them. And one of the things, I don't know how true this was of the original Hussites, but the current Moravians put a very, very big emphasis on the so-called religion of the heart. And, you know, the place of emotion in religion. And they made an important disciple. The Moravians spread throughout Europe, not many of them. It's always been a small church. They came to America in colonial times, and there are still some very old colonial churches, especially in Pennsylvania and North Carolina. But they opened up a church in London in the 18th century in an area called Aldersgate. And there they would have their sermons about the love of God and how important it was and so on. And a Church of England minister, priest, came there and felt himself strangely moved by their testimony. And he's a very important man in the history of Protestantism, and especially American Protestantism, because his name was John Wesley, the founder of Methodism. So, in a sense, John Wesley was kind of a spiritual grandson, if you will, of Jan Hus. And Methodism is a very, very important part of American Protestantism, anyway.
Why is it that Martin Luther has this legacy in terms of the success of the Protestant revolt, whereas Jan Hus kind of petered out?
Well, it's because neither he nor most of his followers enlisted the help of temporal lords in return for church property, which Luther did. I mean, you could say the same thing about the Albigenses in 12th century France. They had some noble supporters, but by and large, it didn't go anywhere. And the reason, again, Protestantism succeeded because it allowed kings and great noblemen to pillage the church in a way that previous heresies simply hadn't. And also, at that point in time, the modern state had developed sufficiently that having someone at the top of the state apparatus gave them a means of control that hadn't existed before.
I see. All right. Our final question today is from Robert.
All right.
Question for Charles regarding the divine right of monarchs. How do we know that a ruler has the divine right to rule? How do we determine this? Is this the mere assent and consecration of the church, the kingdom of God on earth? Is this through genetic lottery, through birth in nobility? Is it the impartiality of a person to make him credible, to be an arbiter for all estates? Is it through merit or natural talent or victory in contests or combat, I being a manifestation of divine favor? Is it through preceding laws and customs and social traditions? Is it through a kind of social contract with rules like oaths of fealty and patronage? Or is it from the de facto conditions of the state at the time? Thank you, and God bless you, and the Book Baron, and all of Tumblr House. This is a great question.
Well, it is, and the answer is any of those or any combination of them, even all of them at once. You know, it.
That's how we know that a ruler has a divine right?
Well, indeed. I mean, if you look at the origins of the European monarchies, you'll see that they came about in very, very different ways. And sometimes, how do I put it? It's kind of sketchy ways. So, for instance, the different dynasties in Spain, because remember, prior to 1492, well, prior to Ferdinand and Isabella getting married, you had several major kingdoms in Spain, and several of them were the results of mergers. So, you had perhaps six or seven proto-kingdoms that were very tiny in the northern part of the country that were all that was left, all that held out against the Moors. And bit by bit, they pushed them back, and some of them merged until you ended up at the time of Ferdinand and Isabella with Castile, Aragon, Portugal, and Navarra. And three of them merged under Ferdinand and Isabella. Well, their origins were interesting. The Muslims enveloped Spain, and in a little cave called the Covadonga in Asturias, you have the germ of what would become the kingdoms of Castile and Leon. In the northern, the southern foothills of the Pyrenees, you had the germ of what would become the kingdom of Aragon. In the Franks under Charlemagne, pushing into Catalonia, you had the beginnings of what would become Catalonia. And then the same was true with Portugal. The Duke of Aviz was an illegitimate son of a king of France and had a castle in what's now the far north of Portugal, was the progenitor of the royal family of Portugal. So you had a mix of things. The Merovingian kings of the Franks were the progeny of the first king of the Franks to become Catholic, Clovis. But when his offspring became incapable of ruling for whatever reason, the Pope approved their being replaced by the Carolingians under Charlemagne's father. So it varied. It varied.
Okay. So one of Robert's questions here is it through preceding laws and customs and social traditions? So this lends me to ask, because you're saying it's varied, is there a divine right of precedence? Because through preceding laws and customs and social traditions and God's divine providence?
No, because no presidency has ever claimed that sort of thing. No president has ever claimed to rule by the grace of God. That's a strictly monarchical thing. Presidencies in and of their nature rest upon the quote-unquote will of the people. And they always have. That's their nature.
Regardless of what they say, wouldn't they have a divine right, though? I mean, a right isn't something that you have to talk about. It just is.
Well, that's true, except, again, that with the kings, the idea was always the case that the authority was based on a direct compact with God. It goes all the way back to the Bible. I mean, the Christian kings saw themselves, and their people saw them, as participating in the kingship of Christ, which itself was the Davidic kingship, the fulfillment of the Davidic kingship. This has nothing to do with the presidencies that we know, and neither their subjects nor they expect it from them, nor will they do it.
I guess I don't understand, and because I'm trying to parse this.
Well, the problem again is that you're coming to it from a completely Republican background.
Yeah,
and so it's a little bit difficult to understand that. Between the king and his people is a spiritual bond and a familial one. Now, sometimes the line fails, or sometimes, as happens, a new people emerge with a new king, a new monarchy. Usually it has to do with their acquiring the Catholic faith. And when that happens, whatever pagan arrangements they had are changed. So Clovis, for instance, when he became the king of the Franks, by virtue first of his conquest, but then his baptism, and then his coronation, you had a new monarchy established because the old setup was pagan. Just as there's a huge difference between the Roman Empire under Theodosius and under his predecessors. Now, the presidencies, each and every one of them, are the product of the Enlightenment. And they have a very different reason for being. They're not based in anything but the quote-unquote will of the people.
Well, I guess what is kind of being a problem for me is, I guess, some of Mother Angelica's words, where in terms of responsibility, where you have a certain response, not just presidents or kings, but everybody has a certain responsibility because God entrusts them with it.
This is true, but you've got to remember that it's, again, people always love to take the people of Israel and the book of Samuel as showing God's dislike of monarchy. It was Thomas Paine who came up with that argument, and he himself thought it was ridiculous because he didn't believe in the Old Testament. But in the book of Leviticus, it already explains, this is before Samuel came along, it explains what God expected out of the kings of Israel. This is before they were a kingdom. He was already looking forward to establishing a monarchy in Israel. And of course, ultimately, he and his second person would be the inheritor of that monarchy. Anyway, Saul was expected to act like a king, even though God knew in his providence that David would eventually be the king, not Saul. He failed to act as a king should, and he lost the throne. Not through popular rebellion, but through the action of God himself. Now, with the presidency, this, on the one hand, if you are a president, you do have a certain responsibility under God, simply because you've got a position of power. But that, like the judges of Israel, who also had that responsibility, that doesn't mean that's the final say, the final form, the perfect end-all and be-all. If the judgeships of Israel had been, then you would never have had a monarchy in Israel. You would never have had the Davidic kingship, and there would never have been anything for Christ to inherit. So similarly, turning it around, on this side of our Lord's coming, he is King of Kings. That's an important title. It's not just poetry. Despite the fact that our system is entirely messed up from top to bottom, beginning to end, the president still has certain responsibilities under God, even if the system he presides over is screwy. The same is true of any pagan monarch. You see, if nothing else, the Emperor of Japan and the Ottoman Sultan are expected to abide by the natural law. Even if you can't expect them to be good Catholics, you can expect them, and certainly God does, to abide by the natural law. And if they don't, there will be consequences of one kind or another. We have erected the American presidency into, as several sociologists have put it, into the high priest of the American civil cult. And we have invested the presidency with a sanctity that is not to be found in the Constitution. But that's because people, human beings, have a natural need and desire to have leaders so invested. You might say, in a sense, that we've made the governmental equivalent of idols for ourselves. And we inaugurate them, and we put them in the White House, and we expect them to act as fathers of the people, when in truth, they're only heads of a given political party. But we expect more out of them than either they or their office are capable of giving us. Sometimes they come very close, though. But regardless of all of that, if you were elected president of the United States tomorrow, you would, under God, have several obligations. One of them would be to try to bring the law of a country, to the best of your ability, into accord with natural law. So that would mean, ending infanticide. Not murdering old people. Not murdering sick people. Probably legal murder would be a good thing to get away from. Marriage, too, would be something probably one wouldn't want to profane. And there are other things. I mean, you would want to make provision for the poor. You would want to make provision for the defense of the population. You'd want to do your best to make sure they weren't starving. Those are all very, very basic things that natural law dumps on any ruler, the common good. We have the existence of the common good, even.
I see. Okay, I think that clarified a lot of things in terms of the king being a father of his country, whereas the president, that's not his role. He's the head of the party, and he can't be everything the king can. But
Yeah.
he nevertheless has certain roles and responsibilities.
Yeah, within the limited scope that he has, he still, under God, has certain requirements. They're not, you can't expect as much out of a president as you can out of a sovereign, because it's not there. And in a certain sense, we do, and to the degree that we do, we are being unfair.
That's an interesting diagnosis there. Okay. Wow, we really oscillated in this one from craziness to friendship simulator to serious discussion. We really, but I think the people like that.
Well, it's a little bit, if I may say so, it's a little bit like the work of Tumblr House's star writer,
Who's that?
Bill Biersack. And what was the great thing about Bill Biersack's mysteries? You never knew.
That's true.
Is there a natural answer, or is it preternatural? Or is it both? Or is it neither? He always kept you guessing, and people like that because it keeps them guessing. It keeps things fresh. So similarly, I think that a combination of the serious and the inane, especially in times which become ever crazier, is, if nothing else, a great way to help our audience stay sane, to say nothing of ourselves. And the several hundred people trapped in the Tumblr House Tower who depend upon you for their daily bread. I say trapped. All right, that's a hate fact. Freely associated.
Yes,
A love fact.
Is there any hate fact that you can't turn into a love fact?
Not these days. It's all a question of who's doing the loving, I mean, from some standpoints, the Internal Revenue Service is a love fact. You're showing your love for your masters by paying up.
That's true.
See? And now, speaking of our masters, we've got to remember a couple of things. By the time our audience sees this, the date will be the 9th. This coming Sunday, which will be the day before, is Sexagesima Sunday, which means the season of Carnival of Mardi Gras is rapidly coming to an end. The 12th is going to be Chinese New Year. As you said earlier, I forget it was the pre-show of this show. But it's going to be Chinese New Year, which, thanks to the COVID monster, will be a shadow of its former self. But nevertheless, it's going to be the year of the ox. So have a steak or something on the 12th to celebrate. And then, a week from Sunday is Quinquagesima Sunday. And then the next day is Lundi Gras. And the following day after that is Mardi Gras. And then comes Ash Wednesday. So, ladies and gentlemen, be thinking of what you're going to be giving up for Lent. Remember, the more you give up in Lent, the more you should party during this time. But the more you party during this time, the more you should give up for Lent. However, if you don't intend to give up anything for Lent, don't party right now.
Okay. It's gonna be hard.
Yeah.
It's gonna be hard. I'm trying to go on a diet, but I'm just a comfort food eater. It's like I want to eat reasonably, but just there's so much stress going on right now. It's hard.
What's unreasonable about 7 glazed donuts at one sitting? It makes perfect sense to me.
Krispy Kreme's so good, too.
Isn't that? See?
Have you ever had a Krispy Kreme donut?
I have.
What do you think?
It's okay.
What?
It's okay. It's all right. Not bad.
Okay, not bad. Yeah.
Remember, it's got two other rivals.
Not in Europe.
No. No. But it has two rivals in the States.
What, Dunkin' Donuts and Winchell's? What?
Yes, exactly. The Dunkin' and Winchell's.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know my donut places.
What did you think of? that may not be an admission. Love that. A whole lot of loving going on. Let me get my hands on them there donuts. You know, 6 or 7 cups of coffee with a donut purr. Help the coffee go down, you know. I do believe, you know, these are very stressful times, ladies and gentlemen. But remember, at the end of the day, and this is going to sound very weird on my part, but I don't care. At the end of the day, we're all going to croak. And that's very comforting, really, because it means no matter what happens, there's only so much they can do to us.
Oh, what a comforting message, Charles. Boy, that was really great to close on. Oh, well, we're going to croak, and there's only so much they can torture us with, you know?
Well, it's true. I mean, let's turn that around for a second, you know?
Yeah, turn it into a love fact.
I will. There was a wonderful old poem, a Crusader's song from the Chronicle of the Dukes of Normandy, that has the line in it, "Counts and princes, they may spoil us, but their spoiling ends at death." I mean, if you think of it, ladies and gentlemen, if you think of eternity, if we make it to heaven, all of this will be like a bad dream. All of the nonsense and the rot, the idiocy, not to say the idiocracy, that's the moronic supremacy, which month we're celebrating in April. It'll all be gone, and they can take it and stuff it. I mean, they can take it and stuff it now, for all I care, but then they really will be in a position to. I think that it's probably not a bad thing to remember a saying of General Gordon, the hero of Khartoum, who died defending the city, who said, "Every man has a final weapon. His life. And if he's unwilling to use it, it destroys its effectiveness." I think there's a lot of truth to that. And certainly whatever else you think of him, there's some not nice things you could think about him if you wanted. Nevertheless, Gordon was quite correct there, and he did demonstrate it in his own life. Because of his sacrifice, he saved a lot of people. Whom the Mahdi and his forces would have murdered otherwise. So that's a comforting thought in the sense that, as Pope Benedict said, we're not called to happiness, we are called to greatness. And that's a difficult calling. Without a doubt, and never more than at the beginning of the week. And you know why?
Why?
Yes.
Because if it's Monday,
then it must be off the menu?
That's right. But what about the soul you save?
I would say there's a better and even chance. Could be your own.
See you next time.
God bless all.